This is the TSN MMA show with Aaron Bronstetter and Bazooka Joe Valtellini.
Dana White says he's not interested in a lightweight super fight involving George St. Pierre. Meanwhile, Tony Ferguson possibly hints he may be fighting GSP next. UFC 229 is already the second highest gate in UFC history. Dana White also says the UFC is now worth, Dr. Evil Pinky, $7 billion. And why it's okay for fans to kick James Gallagher while he is down. Goes in China leading up to Glory 57, and I'm flying solo. We're joined by Justin Gaethje, who headlines the UFC's upcoming card in Lincoln, Nebraska, and the UFC's Vice President of Athlete Development, Forrest Griffin. And hey, it's our one-year anniversary, 52 weeks, and this is our 52nd episode. So if you don't think we're entertaining, fine, but at the very least, we are consistent. Thanks to those listening on TSN Radio in Toronto and Ottawa or to the podcast. Please tell your friends, review the show, and subscribe. We appreciate all of your patronage. Without a Patreon account, we don't need one of those. We just want you guys to listen. Not to knock anybody with a Patreon account, because they're pretty cool. If you have the following, go for it. So GSP, where do we get started with GSP? Dana White says he's not interested in making a lightweight super fight involving GSP, and Tony Ferguson's hinting at a fight with GSP. So let's carry the one, carry the two, multiply by three. If Tony Ferguson loses to George St. Pierre, wouldn't that make George St. Pierre the number one contender? Now, of course, this fight is a complete, it's just imaginary at this point. We saw Tony Ferguson say, UFC 229, mentions somebody who's interested in pterodactyls. So to me, again, doing a little math there, he's talking about GSP because GSP's hobby is paleontology. Now, the one part about Tony Ferguson's tweet that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense is that you don't need to add Tony Ferguson and GSP to UFC 229. Why? Like, UFC 229 is close to sold out, already the second highest gate in UFC history per Dave Meltzer, somewhere between $12 and $17 million. You've already announced the co-main event. You've got Derek Lewis and Alexander Volkov. So if that's your co-main, you're not going to put on the main card Tony Ferguson versus GSP. That's a sellable fight. You could headline UFC 230 with it at MSG. You could headline UFC 231 with it in Toronto, which I think would be a better landing spot given GSP's Canadian following. That being said, if you need a main event for UFC 230, I saw somebody tweet yesterday that they've heard a potential UFC 230 main event that comes way out of left field. I don't know what that is. They didn't name names, but I think that's the way it's got to be. There's really no other fight that makes sense for UFC 230. And now there's been rumors about John Jones. John Jones has been saying, oh, I'm coming back soon. Does he know something we don't? The California State Athletic Commission basically gave him a year and a half suspension, which means he'd be eligible early next year. However, they also said they were going to go along with whatever USADA decided. Now, if USADA decides that it's a one-year suspension for John Jones, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. On this week's card, you've got George Sullivan. He faced, a two-year suspension for his second defense. So John Jones, whether his fault or not, has a second defense, and he's going to get just 1 year after already serving a year. And then right when he comes back, he has to serve another year. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, that being said, this is an entertainment industry. The UFC, as much as people want to call it a sport, is a promotion. And they have fights to promote, and John Jones is one of their biggest stars. And he's been out for a year. So what do you do? I mean, you could have him headline UFC 230 against either Cormier, which I think is the bigger fight, but also puts at risk the fight that's already lined up with Brock Lesnar, or you put him up against Alexander Gustafsson. Now, oddly enough, John Jones has been more active than Gustafsson. He's fought more recently than Gustafsson. Be that as it may, Gustafsson was recently pulled off of UFC 227 in LA. He was supposed to fight Volkan Ozdemir. Ozdemir got injured. Then Gustafsson disclosed that he too had an injury, which Dana White recently called a serious injury. So I don't know how soon Gustafsson could potentially be ready to fight again. Guy barely fights lately. Seems like he's been very, very inactive. Fought Glover Teixeira most recently, and that was, I think like May of last year. I remember thinking about that fight in Dallas. I think it had just happened, and I was in Dallas for UFC 211, which is in May. Speaking of Dallas, we got Dallas coming up, UFC 228. It's on the horizon. Very good card. I like UFC 228 a lot. I think there's just a lot of, it's one of those cards like UFC 211 that just had a lot of really good fights on it. It doesn't have a very sellable main event. It's Darren Till against Tyron Woodley, and I've got a feature coming out on SportsCenter next week about Darren Till and just how crazy his rise is. His rise to the top is just astronomical. If you look at 1 year ago today, recording this August 21st, probably we'll release it August 21st. If you're listening on radio, it was recorded a couple days ago. He would have just beaten Jessen Ayari in May and had a fight coming up with Bojan Velišković. Jessen Ayari, I don't even know if he's in the UFC anymore. Darren Till had just missed weight. It was in Sweden. It was 176 pounds. It's been kind of a trend with Darren Till that people discuss, given that he missed weight for his last fight against Stephen Thompson. But here's what his UFC career had looked like. He was 2-0-1. He had a draw with Nicholas Dalby in a fight of the night in October 2015. Took nearly 2 years off because of injury. Gets a win over Jessen Ayari. Has only fought on television once. In his debut against Wendell de Oliveira. On the card, Condit versus Alves. And that's it. One televised fight. And since then, he hasn't had another televised fight except for Stephen Thompson, his last win. It was a main event on Fox. Big, big, big platform for him. But he's still never fought in North America. Fights in Liverpool, it's in the afternoon. I don't know what the viewership for that was. But he has barely done anything that would get him on the map in North America, that where people would say, I know who this guy is. The win over Thompson, obviously a massive win. Win over Cerrone, a big win. But Till, in his career, he's 5-0-1 in the UFC. It's a very good record. Still only 25 years old. His rise to a title fight has been unheralded. I can't think of another guy. But Cody Garbrandt is another guy who had that kind of a rise. But he was on TV a lot, getting first-round knockouts. Till really only has one finish in the last 3 years. And it was that great finish over to Donald Cerrone. But, I mean, if you watch that fight with Jessen Ayari, he could have been KO'd several times, and he has four knockdowns. So, I mean, this is a heavy hitter. I'm not trying to diminish the power of Darren Till. It's just amazing what this guy's been able to achieve in such a young career, so early in his career. And after that Jessen Ayari fight, again, you beat a guy like Jessen Ayari that a lot of people haven't really heard of on a non-televised fight after missing weight. He comes out and says, I will win the title. Mark my words, I'm going to win the title. The confidence of this kid is crazy. And he said that just over a year ago. It was May of 2017 he said that. And look at what he's done in that time. It's really unbelievable. But I digress. Going back to GSP. Dana White says he's not interested in a super fight, but why? Why? Why wouldn't you be interested? And if you're Conor McGregor and you beat Khabib Nurmagomedov and you're looking for that next big fight, wouldn't a title defense against Georges St-Pierre be that fight? Wouldn't that make the most sense financially for both? Again, this is not a sport. It's a promotion. Mixed martial arts is the sport. The UFC is a business. And they're looking to make money. And if you listen to what Dana White said when he was talking to Tony Robbins and a big crowd in Las Vegas, I think it was 2,200 people, he said the UFC is now worth $7 billion. Now, when he said the UFC was worth $4 billion, people scoffed at him. They said said this guy's crazy. The Dallas Cowboys aren't worth $4 billion. He was proven right. WMEING at the time, now Endeavor, buys them for what has recently been disclosed as $4.1 billion. So, you know, people can be a doubting Thomas when it comes to what Dana White says, and a lot of the stuff that he has said has, you know, he's been known to embellish at times, or he's been known to say things that aren't going to happen, they end up happening. But he did say the UFC was worth $4 billion. People laughed, and look at him now. Huge benefactor of that deal. Continues to be the face of the UFC. And if he says it's worth $7 billion, I don't know. Do you give him the benefit of the doubt? You look at what it sold for, and nobody thought it was going to sell for that amount. Who knows? But again, if you put a GSP and Conor McGregor fight anywhere, stadium, you're going to sell it out. Like that's a big ticket attraction. You're talking about a guy that a lot of people think is the best ever going against their biggest star ever in Conor McGregor. And you can't doubt the star power of Conor McGregor if you look at what the gate is for UFC 229. They have built this guy, and he has built himself into a transcendent star in this sport. Really a transcendent sports star. If you look at what, you know, read Forbes magazine, read SI, read ESPN the magazine, where they rank all the different star power among the world's biggest stars. And his name is in the conversations, in the mix. No baseball players or hockey players on that list. That's how big Conor McGregor is. He's a transcendent figure in sports. He has a loss on his record. I mean, not an undefeated guy. Just a guy that knows how to put butts in the seat. And we saw that last year. It's almost the one-year anniversary of McGregor versus Mayweather. A mixed martial artist against a boxer. It's still crazy to me that that ever happened. Not as crazy as the fact that Floyd Mayweather was only a minus 250 favorite at close, which when you really think about it again, is pretty crazy. But Conor McGregor has become a transcendent star. And if you put him against Georges St-Pierre, that is, you know, Faraz Zahabi said he thinks it could be the biggest fight, not now, but the biggest fight for the next 20 years in this sport. He could be right. It would be absolutely crazy, especially if you can get Georges St-Pierre, if you can convince him to fight at lightweight, whether it's against, you know, that Nate Diaz fight fell through, but if it's against the Tony Ferguson, and he gets a win there. And Georges isn't that much older than Tony Ferguson. Tony Ferguson's still an older guy in the sport. But if he can beat Tony Ferguson, and he's got a good path to beat Tony Ferguson. If you looked at, even though Ferguson beat Castillo, Castillo was taken down at will. And Ferguson's a very tricky guy off his back, but Georges St-Pierre trained to the Danaher Death Squad. If there's somebody who can get out of tricky positions, Georges St-Pierre could be that guy. On the feet, I think Tony Ferguson might have an advantage there, but again, we saw the evolution of GSP when he fought Bisping and what he looked like on the feet. That would be a really interesting fight. Now, whether it's a big ticket attraction, I don't know. In Toronto, it would sell out the ACC, no problem. Sorry. Rewind. The Scotiabank Center. Scotiabank Arena. All these Scotiabank. There are so many Scotiabank arenas in Canada, I can't even keep track anymore. So Scotiabank Arena, that's the one. Still getting used to that. He would sell that out, no problem. Especially him against Ferguson, no problem. Probably do 400,000 to 600,000 buys. Probably closer to the latter number, because Georges St-Pierre has proven to be a sell. And you see that fight with Bisping last year. Good numbers for that fight. So I think if you have Georges St-Pierre beat Ferguson, the obvious next fight has to be GSP against the winner of Conor versus Khabib, or just against Conor if Conor loses. Or against Khabib if Khabib loses. But I think the obvious next fight is Conor versus GSP if he's able to beat Ferguson. And if he loses to Ferguson and Conor loses to Khabib, you make that fight anyways. These are a business, and you want to make money. So that's where I stand on that. I mean, you might accuse me of having a Canadian bias, but look me in the eyes and tell me that GSP versus Conor has no chance of being the biggest fight that the UFC ever does. You can't with a straight face. You just can't. It would be an unbelievable fight. Later on the show, we're joined by Justin Gaethje, UFC Fight Night in Lincoln, Nebraska. Pretty solid card. A lot of good names on that card. Interesting fights. A lot of fighters coming off losses that are looking to bounce back, so I'm looking forward to seeing how that one goes. We'll talk about it later on in the show. James Gallagher loses this weekend, I guess last Friday at Bellator. A lot of people are saying, why are people ripping this guy? He lost. He's a young kid. And I understand it, and I'm not one of the people that's going to celebrate anybody losing in this sport. I think this is a sport where you have to be crazy to do it. I respect absolutely everybody that does this sport, whether they do it recreationally, whether they do it on an amateur level, professional level. You have to respect people that compete in this sport. There's just no way around it. But you look at James Gallagher, he's a young kid. Now 7-1 after the loss to Bandejas on Friday. He's turning 22 at the end of the year, but just so young in his career. He's looking to set up a title fight, and he's talking all kinds of trash. He gets right in Bandejas' face before the fight, and Bandejas just kind of takes it with a grain of salt. I mean, with James Gallagher, this guy's... People look at this guy like he's a big star, but who's he beaten? Who's he beaten in the sport that make him anything other than just a guy with hype? His biggest win is against Chinzo Machida, who's 41 years old now and is 5-3 in MMA and professional mixed martial arts. And he hasn't beaten anybody. So when you talk about James Gallagher being the super prospect, show me something. Show me absolutely anything, and I'll buy it. Bandejas comes into the sport, having fought good guys on the regional level. He has a win over Mirab Dvalishvili. He's beaten good guys. He's beaten undefeated fighters. And even his record doesn't scream to me a guy that, you know, is a super prospect. He's a great fighter. He showed that when he knocked out James Gallagher in the first round, 2 minutes and 22 seconds of their fight. But really, oh, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong thing. He knocked him out 2 minutes and 49 seconds of the first round. I'm sorry, I was looking at Gallagher's win over Machida. So when you see James Gallagher say he's in line for a title fight, get in the face of Ricky Bandejas, and believe me, I know that it's easier to get a title fight in Bellator than it is in a major, in, you know, the UFC. I don't want to say Bellator is not a major promotion. Of course, they're number two in the world, or at least in North America. But this guy's talking all kinds of junk, wants to fight Darian Caldwell. And he loses to Bandejas in the first round. So people are confused as to why people are cheering against this guy? I mean, Conor McGregor talks all kinds of junk. And he comes into the UFC and talks trash. He was a two-division champion in Cage Warriors. That's a legit regional organization. He had beaten good guys. Comes into the UFC, talks all kinds of smack, keeps winning fights winning fights against big names, good guys. Chad Mendez. Dennis Seaver, you know, you can question Dennis Seaver and how good he is, but he has a lot of quality wins. Marcus Brimage, a good fighter. He's beating good guys. James Gallagher hasn't beaten anybody, and he's coming in and he's talking about how he's the next guy in Bellator. And I still think that James Gallagher has tons of potential. A lot of people say, oh, SBG, the only guy that's come out of there is Conor. And I think those people are crazy. SBG has put a lot of good fighters out there. Might not be champions, other than McGregor. But they're a legit gym. To say otherwise, you're kidding yourself. At least with Glendale Fight Club, when you look at Ronda, they haven't really put anybody else on the map. You can question what they've put out. And you look at other guys like Travis Brown, Brendan Schaub, guys that trained there. And what happened with them? I'm not sure how much Schaub trained there, but I'm pretty sure he trained there for one fight. A guy like Jake Ellenberg trains there. You look at what the output is, and you can question whether or not that's a good gym. SBG, you can't question. This is a good gym. They put out good prospects and good fighters. James Gallagher, 21 years old. I still think he can become a champion one day. But if you're going to question why people are stepping on this guy when he's kicking this guy when he's down... He's talking about how he wants a title shot. He gets right in Bandejas' face before the fight. He's talking all kinds of smack about Bandejas on social media, like he's going to run through this guy. Bandejas calm and collective when this guy's in his face, and Bandejas is like a New Jersey guy. You know, you don't want to mess with guys from Jersey. He's just calm. He says, okay, let's whatever. We'll see what happens in this fight. And he gets a statement win. Throws a sidekick that floors Gallagher, finishes with punches. Spectacular highlight. And James Gallagher handles it the same way Conor McGregor handled his loss, with grace. Humbled. Wants to come back and show people what he can do. That needs to be respected. But when you look at a fight in the schoolyard, and that's really what the average person relates to, is a schoolyard fight. And you look at the bully who talks all kinds of smack, who says, I'm gonna beat this guy up after school. I'm gonna go into the yard and beat this guy up. And then the quiet guy who has no choice but to fight this guy because he, you know, that's just how the schoolyard rules go sometimes. He beats up the bully. Everybody laughs at the bully. That's just what's in our nature. So when people are kicking James Gallagher while he's down, I think that it's foolish for people to come out and say, I don't get it. I don't get why people are making fun of this guy. I'm not making fun of the guy. I'll be clear. I have the utmost of respect for James Gallagher for doing something that I would never do and something that everybody who's laughing at him would never do. So it's easy for people to laugh from a keyboard and say, oh, this guy got what was coming to him. Fine. Do I think it's an acceptable behavior? No, but I think that our human nature, unfortunately, at times, our knee-jerk reaction is that guy had it coming to him. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. I mean, can you argue that a guy who says he's going to run through somebody and talks all kinds of junk about him has something like that coming to him? I don't know. It's nothing I would say personally. But I think a lot of people's first thought when Bandejas scores a knockout win over a guy who was right in his face before the fight and Bandejas was cool and collective is that that's what they wanted to see happen. Now, if Gallagher would have beaten Bandejas in the first round, I think people would still want to see James Gallagher get beat down the line. That's just our nature. That kind of personality, like a Connor. And when Connor lost to Nate, it was the same thing. And Connor comes out, handles it in a humble fashion, answers questions from the media, handles a loss the way that you want to handle a loss. But it's all drama. It's all storytelling. Look at Ronda Rousey now. She's the women's champion in Raw. She's back on top of the world. Everybody laughed her out of MMA. They said she handled losing so poorly, and she didn't come out with her head held high. She hung her head and refused to do media and left the sport and went on to do wrestling. And now she has probably even more fans. The WWE celebrate their wrestlers. They love them. She loves doing wrestling. She's back on top of the world. Good for her. Good for her. Because these people don't need to answer to us. They don't need to answer to the people at home. They don't need to answer to the people in the media. They need to do what they feel is best for their careers. And if James Gallagher says, I'm going to come back and I'm going to win and I'm going to show everybody that I'm the prospect that everybody, you know, that I've been saying I am and that people have been saying that I am, good on him. And I hope he does it. I hope he proves everybody wrong. I hope he shows that this loss was an anomaly and that he is able to get to a bantamweight title fight. And I hope Bandejas is able to show that he's championship caliber because he beat James Gallagher and that he really is that good. Not that James Gallagher was a hype train, that Ricky Bandejas is that good of a fighter. I want to see both these guys succeed. But again, I think that the human nature at our core, when you see a guy get in someone's face before a fight and talk all kinds of smack like they're going to run through them and they lose in the first round, I think the knee-jerk reaction is to say, we told you so. This guy was all hype. That's just how it is. That's how it is in the sport. We live in the moment. We think about what's going to happen next. What's next? We get all excited for a fight. And we think, what's next? Well, what's going to happen now? This sport is as much a soap opera as pro wrestling. We crave these storylines. We want stars. We want to see stars rise, and we want to see stars fall. It's how we're wired. I think that it's because of pro wrestling. A lot of people that are fans of MMA grew up on pro wrestling. And that's why guys like Conor McGregor, who can cut an immaculate promo, resonate with us. Because those are the people we looked up to. Were the people that could do that, that could come out and talk all kinds of smack and then get wins and excite the crowd and do so in an unorthodox fashion. Look at The Rock. He's the biggest star in the world today in terms of Hollywood. The highest grossing actor at the box office, I think, in 2017, if I'm not mistaken. We love him. He can do no wrong in the eyes of the public. He built that through pro wrestling and through his popularity in pro wrestling and building that charisma, the mic skills that have translated over to acting. And he might come back and fight in WWE again and sell out pay-per-views because he loves wrestling. And wrestling fans love him. It's just how we're wired, I think. And I think a lot of people that grew up as martial artists, the Robin Blacks of the world, they look at it as an insult that people are stepping on these guys, kicking them while they're down. And I can completely see where they're coming from in that regard, too. These are people that put themselves on the line, their health on the line, to entertain us. And for us to be anything other than grateful to them for that, especially for what they're getting paid, is really laughable. But that's just how we're wired. I think that's how the general public is wired. We want to see people rise and fall. That's what we love about sport. It's boring if people stay on top for such a long time. Look at Demetrius Johnson. People got bored with his greatness, which is crazy. It makes no sense. What he did to Ray Borg was superhuman. He could do that to me 100 times out of 100. He could throw me in the air, catch me in an armbar, and I would tap out. To do it to a skilled fighter like Ray Borg, guy who barely has any losses on his record, who's one of the best grapplers in the flyweight division, to do it to him in front of a live audience on pay-per-view is absurd. It is absurd. That was not a scripted situation, that he did that in real life. And yet people are still like, oh, yeah, the guy won't take super fights. Oh, yeah. We want him to lose. Well, he's lost now. So are you going to appreciate him now? Now does he get the appreciation? You look at the UFC rankings, people submitting rankings, people have him now like 10th pound for pound, 13th pound for pound. Are you nuts? Like, have you not watched with this guy? Have you not seen this guy's body of work? How long it's been since his last loss? We're in a what have you done for us lately sport. And what Demetrius Johnson had done for us lately before that Cejudo fight is crazy. Like, he's put on great fight after great fight. Sometimes I just don't get it. But in the case of James Gallagher, I get it. I get why people wanted to see him fall. I'll get off this topic now, but I was just surprised to see a lot of people say, oh, why are people picking on this guy? I think it's pretty clear why. And again, it's not me doing it. I have to stress that. I wasn't cheering for James Gallagher to fail. I don't cheer for anybody to fail in this sport. It's the sport of people. This is a sport of bravery. To see what these guys go through before, during, and after a fight is crazy. It's something I wouldn't do. Well, let's continue to UFC Fight Night in Lincoln, Nebraska this coming weekend. Before we discuss it, there's one more thing I wanted to touch on. Yoel Romero says he's off UFC 230. He's not going to get cleared by doctors. Weidman versus Rockhold finally gets signed for UFC 230. But the person that I think I have to feel bad for here is Paulo Costa. Like, Paulo Costa was in a situation that was similar to Darren Till. And Darren Till got a shot at Stephen Thompson. Stephen Thompson, you know, he was the new kid in town, Darren Till. Stephen Thompson gives him a shot. Probably got paid nicely for it, but didn't need to do that. Could have probably said, I want to fight someone who's higher ranked, and we wouldn't have blamed him. But gives him the shot. Darren Till excels. Middleweight division, Yoel Romero, the number one ranked guy. A guy who I think shouldn't be champion because he missed weight. But a guy who I thought beat Robert Whittaker. I thought he clearly beat Robert Whittaker in that last fight. He pretty much is champion. Like, I mean, he's championship caliber. And they were gonna have a hungry lion, young lion like Paulo Costa, fight him at Madison Square Garden. Biggest opportunity of Paulo Costa's career by far. They were gonna see what this kid was made of. And now, Yoel Romero can't fight, and Paulo Costa's kind of in a holding pattern. Other than Romero, if Romero is cleared by the end of the year, there's just nobody available for Paulo Costa to fight in the middleweight division. Rockhold and Weidman are set up. Gastelum and Whitaker set up for the future because they did tough together. And I mean, they could ask Gastelum to fight Paulo Costa. I just don't think that would make a whole lot of sense. Take all the wind out of the sails of that tough season. Jacare fighting David Branch. Brunson fighting Adesanya. Antonio Carlos Jr. fighting Elias Theodoru. Jotko's got a fight lined up. Santos moving up to light heavyweight to fight Jimmy Manoa. Great fight. Glad they made that fight. It was the fight that I thought was the obvious one to make, and they got it done. Uriah Hall just lost to Paulo Costa. There's nobody for Paulo Costa to fight. Absolutely nobody. You got to feel for the kid. He's only fought once this year. He's young. I'm sure he wants to get out there. You look at what Paulo Costa's done in the UFC, and it's nothing short of exhilarating. He's only been in the UFC for just over a year, too, just like Darren Till. Oh, actually, sorry, Darren Till came in 2015, but he had that long layoff. First round knockout, second round knockout, second round knockout, second round knockout. Knocked out Johnny Hendricks at MSG last year. Knocks out Uriah Hall during International Fight Week this year in the second round. This guy's never gotten into the third round in his life. Except for when he lost on Tough to Marcio Alexandre Jr., Lyoto, they call him. He's back, sort of back with the UFC. He's fighting on the Contender Series, the Brazilian Contender Series. That fight's already happened. I don't know what the results are. I've been avoiding them. I don't even know if they're available. But I can't wait to watch that. I love the Dana White Contender Series. They're going to have a whole Brazilian season. Whew, that's going to be fun to watch. But you look at what Paulo Costa's done since coming back to the UFC after that Tough stint. Really, even before coming back to the UFC after that Tough stint. It's all first-round finishes. This guy's a killer. And they were going to put him right into title contention. And now he's got to sit back and wait. And I really feel for the kid. So it's too bad for him. I hope they can figure something out with him. But short of making Gastelum fight him, if I'm Gastelum, I'm turning that fight down, and I'm saying, listen, you got me lined up for a title fight. I'm fighting for the title. I just don't know what you do. So before we start getting into a preview for UFC Fight Night in Lincoln, I'd like to introduce Justin Gaethje, who's fighting in the main event. He joins us on the TSN MMA show, and we discuss his upcoming fight with James Vick this weekend. Now, before we get to this interview with Justin Gaethje, I should warn you, there is some coarse language in this interview. So if you're listening in the car with your kids, I know this is a family show, you might want to fast forward. And here's Justin Gaethje on the TSN MMA show.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to introduce this week's guest.
I'm now joined by one half of the main event for UFC Fight Night in Lincoln, Nebraska. Let's be real, though. Justin Gaethje is the main event. People are tuning in to watch this guy fight because it's always exciting. How are you today, Justin?
I'm good, and James Vick gets to fight in his first main event because of me.
Well, you know what? It's something you can't really argue. I mean, if you look up and down the lightweight division, there are a lot of guys in that division that are outright killers, but I feel like you're a guy that they will put in the main event for the remainder of your UFC tenure just because of how exciting you are, especially on televised cards, because, like I mentioned, on TV, you're the main event.
Yeah. Hey, I have fun. I have fun in there, I'll tell you that.
Well, we have a lot of fun watching you, although there are people that tend to think that your fighting style is just not one that's built for long-term endurance in the sport. Do you agree with them? But, I mean, if you look at the amount of fights you've had, you can kind of argue the other way.
Yeah, there's an argument on both. I'm saying, I mean, they sound pretty smart when they say it like that. I'm not a – this is a young man's game. Who stays in here for a long time? You know, if you've never done this, you know, I wouldn't expect you to understand. But, you know, you have to look at it – in a certain way. Of course, I'm not going to be here forever. You know, I've had 20 fights already. Do I want to have more than 30 fights? No, I don't. Not even if I was to win them all, I wouldn't want to have that many fights. This game isn't built to stay in for a long time. Obviously, you know, you have your exceptions like Randy Couture, who was in forever. But you know, I have a human services degree in college. I want to work. I want to do social work. I want to make some good money on the UFC doing that, and I'm not looking to stay here forever and you know, go past my prime. The day I don't think I can be the best in the world is the day I will not do it anymore.
So would you say the money is the goal right now? I mean, it's very crowded at the top of the lightweight division. Things are back on the tracks. So you got Khabib and Conor coming up. Are you happy just being a guy that headlines cards, puts on exciting fights, or is your eye still firmly set on a title opportunity?
Absolutely on the title. I wouldn't, like, again, if I didn't think I could be the best, I'm not going to stay here. Money is what we fight for. We fight for money, and we are prize fighters. I do not possess any other skill set where I can go out and make this much money on any given night, and that's a fact. Being a social worker, I guarantee I can't do that. So, you know, I never planned on doing this as a kid. I never planned on doing this as an adult. It's just something I kind of you know, came into with pretty much because of my mental fortitude and how tough I have become since because of wrestling. I wrestled for 18 years, and I'm a prize fighter now, but again, I'm not trying to do this forever.
When did you realize that you were a tough guy? Like, what happened in your life before you started fighting professionally where you're like, wow, if I can tough this out, what else can I tough out?
Nothing. I'm such a privileged, compared to most, I'm so privileged. I have the best parents. Really, it's just trying to, you know, my family, both three generations on both sides has worked in the copper mine where I'm from. My dad's been there for 33 years. My brother's there. My uncles are there. Both of my grandpas, their fathers worked there. You know, that's what I was born and bred to do, to be a copper miner, to work hard. And luckily this is just a different path where hard work, you can find success through hard work. And, there was nothing specific. I, wrestled my entire life. When I wrestled Jordan Burroughs and I gave him a hell of a match, then, you know, I knew I was tough. When I was a Division I All-American, I knew I was tough. When I used to, cut 20 pounds a week, I knew I was tough. When I would, train every day, wrestle, three practices a day and then go do a construction job at night or a painting job. You know, I knew I was tough. You know, small things like that. I want to create different opportunities. My parents worked hard. They gave everything they have ever earned to give me opportunities. And, I wanted to take a different path and really accomplish something that they really, that they would be proud of. And, I can only imagine how proud my dad is to walk around the mine and have conversations about, his UFC fighter son. So that's what I was trying to accomplish. And yeah, that's what I'm here for.
Now you mentioned the title. What would it take to get you to that pinnacle, to a title shot, given that you've lost two in a row, you're 1-2 in the UFC, you're still ranked in the top 10.
Yeah.
But what will it take to get you into that picture?
Yeah, it's same for everybody. Some wins, exciting wins, one wins over the correct opponents. I got to beat James Vick and then I got to, keep progressing up the ladder. I fought number 5, number 4, number 3 in my UFC tenure. Michael Johnson is not ranked number 5 anymore. He's not even in the lightweight division anymore. But when I fought him, he was number 3 or number 5, I think. And he had just knocked out Dustin Poirier. So I have faced the best competition, the best opposition that the UFC has to offer me. And, I got to go in there. I got to win. Winning is the name of the game. Being exciting is one thing. Being exciting gets you paid, but winning is the name of the game, and that's the only way you progress in this sport. So I got to go out there, get a win over James Vick. I got to get another win late this year, early next year, get another win mid-next year, and then hopefully I'm in the title picture again.
You mentioned excitement.
That's how this game works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned excitement, and there's a value, obviously, on excitement in the sport. That's I think, one of your biggest currencies in terms of a fighter. But you look at the bantamweight division, you've got TJ Dillashaw as the champion. And one guy that keeps trying to make his case that he should be the next guy in line is Rafael Assuncao. And I think he's something like 11-1 in the UFC. His only loss is to Dillashaw, if I'm not mistaken. And then you look at a guy like Marlon Moraes, who Assuncao beat. But Moraes is putting on way more exciting fights. And I think a lot more people consider Moraes to be next in line versus a guy like Assuncao. Do you agree with that kind of mindset, that there is a certain value that exciting fighters have in a promotional sport like the UFC?
Yeah, I mean, it's an entertainment business. I mean, there's no way around that. But does Rafael Assuncao deserve it? Absolutely. He has finishes. He also has some boring fights. And, they can be detrimental to your career in the UFC. I can only imagine the opportunity that the UFC wants to give Derek Lewis or Francis Ngannou right now. I'm sure they're not going out of their way to try and create a big opportunity for those guys, and deservedly so. I don't think they deserve it. But, 11-1, he has faced top opposition. He's beat a lot of good guys, and I think Rafael Assuncao does deserve it. As a fan, who do I want to see? I want to see Marlon Moraes. And that's just the name of the game. That's how it works. So I don't have an answer as to why that's the case, but it is how it is.
I guess it's a balancing act between merit and excitement.
Yeah. I mean, Marlon Moraes wouldn't be in the conversation if he didn't possess the merit. I think he does possess the merit. I think that fight with Rafael Assuncao was very close. I think you can argue that he won that fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so that know, that is something. That's just that's something that we have to talk about when we have this conversation. We can't just not bring that up. They fought each other, and it was a very close fight. He has knocked out brutally, you know, top opposition since then. Rafael has had some boring fights since then. So, yeah, I mean, as a fan, I want to give it to Marlon. As a UFC, I want to give it to Marlon. And that's just the way it is. So you either figure it out or you complain.
Yeah, I would never question the merit of Marlon Moraes. The guy's a killer. And it's been great seeing a fellow former World Series of Fighting champion in him and yourself come into the UFC and make such names for yourself. Have you been keeping up with the PFL, the former World Series of Fighting? Because I'm loving their format, and I think that what they're doing is really unique and cool.
I like it too. Yes, I think it's awesome. I think it's awesome. It's a great opportunity for these guys. And they're proving that they're a force to be reckoned with over there. People are going to eventually catch on, and it's going to be a mainstream thing, I think.
And you could have been there. It was a $1 million tournament. Do you feel like you left $1 million on the table? You could beat those guys, right?
I want to prove I'm the best in the world. There's only one place to do that.
Mm-hmm, yeah, it's tough to argue.
Plenty of opportunities to make $1 million in the UFC.
Yeah, absolutely, especially with your fighting style. And, you know, you look at the top of the division right now, Khabib versus Conor in October. When you look at that fight and you close your eyes, you envision potential outcomes for that fight, what's the first outcome that comes to mind? How do you see that fight playing out in your mind?
I've tried to envision it, and I can't come out with the outcome. You know, it's such an intriguing matchup that who's going to impose their will? Is Khabib going to be able to get inside and take Conor down without getting cracked? You know, I don't have an answer for that.
I spoke to James Vick, your opponent, recently, and he said that he had a bunch of, I guess, prepared insults, so to speak, going into that press conference the other day. Do you feel like he, you know, made you look kind of foolish with those kind of canned responses? Do you feel like you could have had some better preparation going into the press conference?
No.
Or did you not care about that kind of thing?
No, I don't care about that. Maybe you can inform me of what was so intriguing about what he said.
It's not my opinion. He thinks that he made you look bad.
No, I'm the Homer Simpson of MMA.
Yeah, he thinks he made you look bad.
Is that a stat? Is that a statistic?
I guess
not. That's not a real statistic. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's just him being foolish. You know, he's also said that, you know, his volume is more than me. I mean, unless he's counting every backward step he takes as a punch thrown or a kick thrown, then maybe. But, I mean, the guy doesn't get it. The guy doesn't understand why I'm headlining my third out of fourth main event. He doesn't understand why I'm getting the opposition I'm getting. And I'm not the one that needs to teach him. He's supposed to have people around him that tell him, like, dude, obviously what you're saying and doing isn't working. You want top opposition, you go out there and you earn it. He has a great opportunity here. Let's see if he goes out there and capitalizes on it. I can't wait to put him to sleep and fucking stand over him and tell him he's just a huge turd, man. I can't wait to put him to sleep. I can't wait to send him home not being able to look in the mirror for a week. Can't wait to send him home not being able to take a comfortable shit for a week. These are the things I'm looking forward to.
You mentioned volume, and I do have the stats here if you're interested. In your three fights, approximately 8 rounds, you landed 341 strikes. In his 10 fights, approximately 18 rounds, he landed 385 strikes. So it's really kind of night and day.
I know. He just doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. And, you know, you guys want me to, not you guys, but people want me to engage in this kind of rhetoric. Like, I'm not going to engage in that. That's fucking ridiculous that he could even say that and believe it. Like, I'm not going to sit there and be like, oh, you're wrong. Maybe you should go look at the stats. I knew that. I knew that I've had, more, my volume was more in my last fight than his last three fights. I'm not stupid. It's right there on paper. I also have taken a lot more shots than he's taken, and that's also a fact. I fight the way I fight. He fights the way he fights. We're going to go in there and see who can implement their game plan. Can he avoid a fight with me? We'll see. I highly doubt it, but if he does, then props to him. And the flip side is, you know, he's going to be in a war of attrition that he is not mentally prepared for, and he's going to fold. He's going to melt. He's going to melt in front of all of your eyes, and you guys are going to see it. We've seen it before. He doesn't like being in fights. We saw what Benil Dariush did to him. We saw how long he stayed on the mat after he got knocked out. These are all definitions of whether you're a fighter or not a fighter. And you know, the more you look at him, the more he's not a fighter.
I feel like you're the one fighter that you can, people can comfortably say that they can't implement their game plan against you. You do not give guys time to think. The amount of, I guess, stimuli or the amount of output that you put on guys and pace and forward motion is you can either handle it or, you know, you can either handle it or you can't. And I think that that's going to be James Vick's challenge, just to see if he can handle it.
You sign up or sign out. And the last two guys, you know, all the respect in the world, they signed up. Those men signed up. They knew what they had to do, and they went out there and they did it. And I have given them so much props. I have no regrets in the way that I fought those fights. A couple mistakes here and there that, you know, are learning experiences in the UFC. But yeah, you know, I can't wait to tell my kids I fought the best of the best. And you know, one day, like I said, this is James Vick's first main event. It's going to be because of me. And if he lasts longer than 7 minutes, you know, he'll get his second bonus. And you know, that's what we fight for. So I'm looking forward to August 25th. I'm looking forward to knocking James Vick out.
Well, it's coming up very soon. I appreciate your time, Justin. That's the main event. It's going to air on TSN up here in Canada. It's UFC Fight Night in Lincoln, Nebraska, and it's Justin Gaethje against James Vick. And if you want to see a fight that is going to deliver excitement, Justin Gaethje's your guy.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for your time, man.
That was Justin Gaethje, and man, oh man, I cannot wait to see him fight James Vick. That's going to be an excellent fight. We don't really know what James Vick is made of. I hate to say that because he's 9-1 in the UFC. We've seen what he can do. But if you said, can Eddie Alvarez handle a guy like Justin Gaethje? Is there proof that he can? The answer is a resounding yes. If you look at his fights with Chandler, you look at his body of work. He can stand and trade with Justin Gaethje. If you say, can Dustin Poirier handle a Justin Gaethje? You look at his body of work. You look at what he's been through in his career. You look at his fight with Alvarez, the first fight, when, you know, the one that resulted in a no contest that he had before he fought Gaethje, not the most recent one, which happened after the Gaethje fight. It's a resounding yes. I mean, Dustin Poirier can stand and trade with Justin Gaethje. James Vick, I don't know. Like, the problem with James Vick is, other than his fight with Dariush, he hasn't really been tested. There hasn't really been a moment where you look at what James Vick's body of work and you say, this guy really has had tough fights. He won three fights on The Ultimate Fighter Live. One was a split decision with Dakota Cochran. I think that was the elimination round to get onto the show. But you look at the rest of his fights, it's all unanimous decisions, finishes. This guy has not really been tested. Joseph Duffy, believe me, that's a tough. These are tough opponents. I'm not saying that he hasn't been tested by tough opponents, but you haven't really seen him fight somebody where you know what they're going to bring to the table, like a Justin Gaethje. And I'm not saying that James Vick cannot pass that test. Oh, believe me, he knows what he's getting into. He's probably trained it. He's probably drilled it. But when you're in there, when you're in the pressure cooker with a Justin Gaethje, it's do or die. Like, you cannot do anything but fight his fight, because he doesn't let you. He just pushes forward and he stands and he trades with you. So is James Vick going to be able to handle that? We'll find out on Saturday. That's what makes it such an exciting fight. That's what makes it such a unique fight. Because we saw what Justin Gaethje did to Michael Johnson. And Michael Johnson dropped Justin Gaethje in that fight. And Michael Johnson's the type of guy where you could look at his resume and say, yeah, he can probably handle the pressure of a Justin Gaethje. If he hits you, he'll drop you. James Vick doesn't really have that one-punch power. We haven't seen it, really. We've seen him get finishes, but we haven't seen him really, like, knock a guy out cold. And if we have, maybe I just don't remember it. The guy's only got 3 TKO finishes. I mean, actually, he had that knee on the Ultimate Fighter against Crookshank. James Vick's just such a unique fighter. 6'3", 155 pounds. He's huge for the lightweight division. An absolute monster. To have that kind of size as an asset is really something you cannot understate. But against a guy like a Justin Gaethje, I don't know. I mean, he's going to be put in the pressure cooker, and it's going to be do or die. Do I think he passes the test? I really don't know. If I had to pick a side, I think Gaethje is going to overwhelm him. But James Vick's proven a lot of people wrong. A lot of people wrong. If you look at his body of work in the UFC, whew, just a guy that gets it done. He can go the distance with you. His gas tank is good. He can knock you out. He can sub you. He can do everything. He is a well-rounded mixed martial artist. And so is Gaethje, but Gaethje doesn't show a lot of his game. Gaethje is an all-American wrestler. You don't see him go for takedowns. He just marches forward, bites down on his mouthpiece, throws crazy leg kicks, crazy punches, and just overwhelms you. Now, here's the big question with Justin Gaethje. Where does he go from here, win or lose? With a loss, he's 1-3 in the UFC. And from there, I think you just have to start making exciting fights. I think he just becomes an attraction. I don't think he's really got title hopes if he loses this fight. That's when you say, all right, we're going to put Gaethje up against an Edson Barbosa. We're going to put Justin Gaethje up against an Alexander Hernandez. We're going to just put him in firefights. Now, what that does with his career longevity, I mean, I don't know how much career longevity he has with his fighting style, but he's had a really good amount of fights already. You look at his pro record. Not like this guy's new to the sport. He's 18-2. He's had 20 wars. Guy's a beast. How much he has left, I don't know. Especially if he loses this fight. But if he wins this fight, now you open up a lot of options. I mean, Barboza might be the next fight for him anyways. But if he wins this fight, all it takes is another win or two to get into title contention. If he wins in the way that he fights with that kind of style, you look at him versus a Kevin Lee. You look at him versus, like I mentioned, the Barboza against a Tony Ferguson, against Connor if Connor doesn't win, against Khabib if Khabib doesn't win. There's just so much that Justin Gaethje can do going forward. And I'm excited to see it either way. I think that Justin Gaethje versus anybody is a great fight. There's really nobody in the lightweight division where you say, this guy versus Justin Gaethje, nah, that's going to be a stinker. It just doesn't exist. Just Justin Gaethje's just, he's the type of guy where you put him in a fight and I'm watching. He's one of the few people in the UFC where you can say he's undoubtedly must-see TV. If you put him in the main event against anybody, it's must-see TV. And there are very few people in the UFC that are like that. Cowboy Cerrone is one of those guys. Where you put them in the main event and people are going to watch. Jimmy Rivera, I think, is becoming one of those guys. Conor, obviously, he's not must-see TV. He's must-see pay-per-view. People are going to pay money to see Conor McGregor fight. But really, looking up and down the divisions, you used to think of Ngannou that way, but now you look at what happened in his last two fights. Maybe not anymore. Junior Dos Santos, he's hit or miss, I think, sometimes. Gustafson puts on good fights, but is he must-see TV? I don't know. Calvin Gastelum always has fun fights. Is he must-see TV? I don't know. If you're the viewer at home, there are just so few people that you can point to them and say, this person is must-see. You cannot miss this fight. And if I'm talking to somebody who's never watched the sport before that I think is going to like fighting, is going to like MMA, I say you're going to watch the fight this weekend. You're going to watch Justin Gaethje versus James Vick because it's not going to disappoint you. It's going to be awesome. You can say it with conviction and look that person in the face and say, this is the fight you want to see. Justin Gaethje versus anybody. Blank. Iaquinta was supposed to be his opponent. Sure. You grab anybody from that lightweight division, you put them up against Justin Gaethje and I'm watching. And I think everybody should watch because I think that's the kind of guy that is going to entertain just anybody who's new to this sport. Anybody who's watched this sport. Now, maybe not Eric Anders, who I spoke to last week and said he doesn't find Justin Gaethje all that entertaining. Maybe there are people that are, you know, very, very into the martial arts part of this sport that would say, yeah, I don't know. I don't know about this Justin Gaethje fellow. I'm not one of those people. I like watching Justin Gaethje. I love what he brings out of his opponents. not just what he brings to the table, what he brings out of an opponent, to see if they can pass that test. He's like calculus. Can you pass that calculus exam? I couldn't. I couldn't pass a calculus exam. I couldn't pass a fight with Justin Gaethje. Don't even know if I could weigh in at 155 pounds. But I know that Justin Gaethje is just going to bring something special out of his opponent every time he gets into that cage. The rest of that card, I think, is pretty good. I think if you look at the co-main event, Michael Johnson versus Andre Feely, that's going to be a fun fight. I think Casey versus Hill, Courtney Casey versus Angela Hill, is a very, very interesting strawweight fight. The output should be crazy. I think Courtney Casey, if you look at her record in the UFC, she is 1-2, 2-2, 2-3, 3-3, 3-5. She might be the best 3-5 fighter in UFC history. She's always in close, close fights. Never been finished in the UFC. But I think what she brings to the table, she's just an incredible mixed martial artist. And then you look at Angela Hill and her record. Her UFC record is, let's see, she goes 1-2, 1-3, 1-3, 2-3, 2-4, 3-4. Now, if Casey's one of the best 3-4 fighters in the UFC, you got to say, or 3-5 fighters in the UFC, Angela Hill might be the best 3-4 fighter in the UFC. Like, these are two great, tough, tough women. Great fighters. That's going to be a fun one. Ellenberger versus Barbarena. Ellenberger is a huge underdog in this fight, but you've got to remember, you look at Ellenberger's record of late, and it is terrible. No other way to put it. 2-8 in his last 10. One of those wins over Matt Brown, one of them is over a pretty washed Josh Koscheck. But you look at who he's lost to: Ben Saunders, Mike Perry, Jorge Masvidal, Tariq Safadine, Stephen Thompson, Kelvin Gastelum, Robbie Lawler, Rory McDonald. That's murderer's row. I mean, you say what you will about Ben Saunders, but he's always going to give you a tough fight. That's murderer's row. Those are tough, tough fights. He is not losing to any cream puffs. Tough, tough opponents across the board. You can say that Barbarena is probably, you know, if it would be probably between him and Saunders of the people that he's lost to. You know, that's how tough these guys are. And Barbarina's a great fighter. But now you've got Ellenberger fighting at training with TJ Dillashaw & Co. at the training lab. He's got a really good camp behind him. Guys that can test him day in and day out. If Ellenberger loses, that's it for him. He's got to call it a day. 2-9 in his last 11. Got to call it a day. Barbarena, his losses come to Leon Edwards, Colby Covington, and Chad Laprise. Those are great, great opponents, too. Wins over Joe Ellenberger, brother of Jake Ellenberger, twin brother. So a little bit of a revenge factor here. Win over Sage Northcutt, win over Warley Alves, who's also on this card, is also a big favorite on this card, and Joe Proctor. So he's got some good wins under his belt, too. He was a big underdog against Warley Alves, as well as Sage Northcutt, and he got it done. This time he's a big favorite. He's on the other side of the table. Let's see if he can deliver. John Moraga versus Davison Figueiredo. That's an excellent fight, too. You look at Moraga's last two wins. Magomed Bibulatov, one of the best prospects in the flyweight division, and Wilson Hayes. Those are two big wins. John Moraga's getting back on the map. He had lost three in a row, and he's bounced back in a big way, winning three in a row. And then you look at Figueiredo. Figueiredo is undefeated, 14-0, one of the best prospects in the UFC flyweight division, despite being the age of 30. Still a prospect, probably, in my eyes, you know, an undefeated guy. He's won three in a row in the UFC. Two guys have won three in a row. We'll see where they stand in the flyweight division after this one. Eric Anders, a 10-1 favorite over Tim Williams. Tim Williams, very good with submissions, but he's in it over his head a little bit here, I think. I think Eric Anders, I mean, you look at what happened with him in his last fight against Pechota with Tim Williams, lost in the first round. I smell a bit of a first-round finish here with Eric Anders. Might just be too tough for Tim Williams. He was on the show last week. Thanks to Eric Anders for joining us last week. James Krause against Warley Alves, another big underdog. But if you look at what Krause has done of late, he's another guy who's quietly racked up four wins in a row. You're going to call him a 4-1 underdog against Warley Alves? Warley Alves is a killer, don't get me wrong. I thought he'd actually have a better career than he's had. The only guy to beat Colby Covington. Only guy to finish Colby Covington. It's a tough fight for James Krause, but James Krause thrives on tough fights. He's a tough guy. That's going to be an interesting fight. Yuri Alcantara, a big underdog against Corey Sandhagen. Are people writing off Yuri Alcantara? I mean, this is a guy who's very, very inconsistent. But if you look at what he did in his last fight against Joe Soto, first round, just 1 minute into the fight, takes out Joe Soto, who's a tough, tough guy. Win over Luke Sanders, who's also on the card last year. But back-to-back losses to Kelleher and Alejandro Perez, two tough guys in their own right. If he loses to Corey Sandhagen, I think we know that Yuri Alcantara's best days are behind him, but to have him as a 2-1 underdog against Sandhagen, I think is that's very interesting. Andrew Sanchez, Ultimate Fighter winner. Since then, 1-2. Was destroying Ryan James last year before James had that huge comeback in the third round. Walked forward like a zombie and took out Andrew Sanchez. Lost to Anthony Smith. We see what Anthony Smith has done since then. No harm in that loss. That's a tough guy, Anthony Smith. But wins over Khalil Roundtree. We saw him knock out Gokhan Saki recently. Win over Trevor Smith, tough guy. Looking to bounce back against Marcus Perez, and I think he does here. I think that, it's interesting that it's an even money fight, but I think that Sanchez can get it done here. It's a winnable fight for him. Mickey Gall opening up the televised preliminary card against George Sullivan, who I mentioned earlier in the show. George Sullivan, I worry his best days are behind him. Coming off a 2-year suspension, lost to Nico Price. Facing Mickey Gall. Mickey Gall, a pretty big favorite, but Mickey Gall coming off the first loss of his career. 4-1 now in professional MMA. But if you look at who his wins are against, aside from the Sage Northcutt win, a win over CM Punk, what does that mean? Win over Mike Jackson? Not sure what that means either. Win over Ron Templeton? Don't know who that is. So Gall really needs to prove that he belongs in the UFC, and I think a win over George Sullivan is definitely a step in the right direction. Joanne Calderwood and Kalindra Faria both coming off 2 straight losses. That should be a fun one in the fight pass prelims. Drew Dober versus John Tuck, 2 veterans of the UFC. And a fight that I love here, Ronda Yahya versus Luke Sanders. Yahya dangerous everywhere, gets submissions. Luke Sanders has shown he's been susceptible to submissions. He got submitted by Yuri Alcantara, but I think Sanders is a fantastic prospect. This is going to be a huge test for him to pass against Ronda Yahya. Ronda Yahya has won 6 of his last 7 fights. So if he can pass that test, Luke Sanders is back on the map, back in the mix. Great card. I think it's an exciting card. I'm excited about our next guest. He's the UFC Vice President of Athlete Development, and also, I probably should mention, a former UFC Light Heavyweight Champion, and he's Forrest Griffin, and he joins us now on the TSN MMA show. Joining us now on the TSN MMA show, he is the Vice President of Athlete Development for the UFC and a former UFC Light Heavyweight Champion, Forrest Griffin. Forrest, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So I've been combing through Volume 1 of the evidence-based analysis book from the UFC's Performance Institute, which I will allow you to say the name of right now.
Yes, a cross-sectional performance analysis and projection of the UFC athlete.
And it's got some great information. Go ahead.
No, as a fancy way to say what the UFC athlete of today looks like.
Yes, absolutely. It's got some really interesting information that I combed over. We've used some of the stats actually on our broadcast, especially when it comes to output. We were comparing the average output to what Justin Gaethje puts out in his average fight, which is really an absurd amount.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The average output for male 155 with Justin Gaethje crushes that.
Yes, I think it's double. It was double or triple, some crazy amount. In terms of punches thrown, or strikes thrown, rather.
Yeah.
But some interesting points I wanted to go over and get your take on. So 31.6% was the submission rate 10 years ago. That's nearly been cut in half. What do you attribute that to?
Well, that's easy. That's if you think about submissions as a specialty, it's less of a specialty and more as a generalist. So everybody is aware of submissions, you know? Everybody knows submissions. And now when you see submissions, they're, you know, rear naked chokes or guillotines. And a lot of times you'll notice that people are kind of hurt, like shook, rocked, for lack of a better term. And that's when they get submitted.
Do you think a lot of the, in terms of submission training right now, you look at the Donaher Death Squad, you look at a lot of the different jiu-jitsu teams, they're getting very innovative in terms of how they can lock on submissions and what they can do with submission attacks. Do you think a lot of that has to do with, I guess, submission awareness in today's MMA and how there's just a lot of innovation needed in order to make submissions more effective?
Yeah, you're hitting on it right there. It's the ebb and flow, right? So everybody develops good jiu-jitsu defense, so you have to kind of rewrite it. You have to kind of come up with new submissions and different things. You're talking about Gaethje. I think Vic's actually a good submission guy because of his length and body type. He can do things that most people can't do, right? So his guard works really well for a modern-day guard where a lot of people don't have a great guard anymore. You know, it's a position where you kind of defend yourself and hopefully don't get beat up and get back up, but you don't see the, you know, arm bars, triangles, sweeps like you used to see from guard.
I have a feeling we won't be seeing a lot of guard play in Gaethje versus Vic, but I digress. The decision rate in 2016 is 50.3%, so it's above 50% of the time we're seeing a decision in fights. Do you think that that's just because of how well-rounded everybody is now?
Yeah, and the other thing is, if you think about conditioning, everybody kind of understands you're going to get that adrenaline jump. This is what a fight feels like. So we're in the second generation, third generation in a lot of cases of coaches. So they understand that at some point you're going to get exhausted, and how do you physiologically and psychologically prepare for that? A lot of people would get submitted and finished, especially at heavyweight, because they would just start to gas out, and the opponent would kind of see that, okay, this guy's got no gas, and then pick it up on him.
One thing that really surprised me was the statistic on injury distribution. Only 10% of the injuries sustained in mixed martial arts, or in the UFC rather, are head injuries, whereas 17% are hand and wrist injuries. Of those head injuries, only 3% of those are concussions. How is that stat determined, and does that show that mixed martial arts may actually be safer than a lot of other sports?
Well, let's not dig too much into that statistic. Not that that's not true, it is, but basically what I'm saying is anytime there's a concussion, a lot of times there's a cut or a facial laceration or, you know, some sort of fracture to, you know, orbital, et cetera. So a lot of that is doubling up on the same thing. But, you know, a lot of times when you have a concussion, you have a cut and vice versa. And the other thing to think about, we're punching in 4-ounce gloves with tape. Of course, your hands, wrists are going to be the most susceptible to break, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's just a lot more contact in that regard. But I thought the head injuries was surprising. The only 10% of the injuries sustained were head injuries. I think that a lot of people talk about head injuries being a big part of the sport. But in terms of the injury distribution, it doesn't seem like as big of a factor as maybe it's talked up to be.
Well, it's funny. Take me, for instance. I mean, I kicked a lot of people in the liver, and I kicked a lot of people in the legs. But I didn't really do that much damage to people's heads. You know, I wasn't a big puncher, so... You know, I would hurt legs and you know, body, ribs. So,
and in terms of the benchmarks, go ahead, Forrest.
There's just a lot of other targets out there.
Absolutely, it just seems that when people talk about that, you know, there's a narrative in the sport that head injuries are a huge, huge concern. And of course, in combat sports, that's obviously a concern everywhere. But then you look at sports like hockey and football, and there are concerns as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, and soccer and gymnastics, and, you know, it's a modern-day problem. You know, it's something we didn't realize. And if you think about, you know, shell shock from World War II, what was that but concussive type, you know, traumatic symptoms, TBIs. So, I mean, it's something that we're aware of, and I think the UFC and the fighting sports as a whole, I know that they've taken them head-on. It is head-on, get it? You know, it is a problem. And, you know, the unfortunate thing, and what I hope if athletes and coaches read this, you're going to get hit to the head. It's one of the most effective ways to win a fight, you know. Significant strikes landed, right? That's one of the biggest indicators of a win. To the head, even, is the one of the huge indicators of winning. So that's one of the goals of the sport. You're going to do it. Do it when you get paid for it. Don't do it in sparring any more than you absolutely have to stay sharp. You know, I think the old days of the, you know, 10 hard 5-minute round sparring are gone, you know.
Yeah, my co-host is not here this week is Joe Valtellini, and he's was a Glory kickboxing champion and retired actually due to concerns with head injuries. But he says that when he's training guys, they stay away from head contact almost altogether.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's something a lot of people are drawn to. And the other thing, you're doing more quality rounds but less less garbage rounds. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, you'll do three hard 5-minute goes instead of five or six, medium pace, you know.
So it's just optimizing time.
Just the volume. You know, you want to cut the volume down. You want to just, you know, if you're in a sparring situation, you're at risk of a head injury. You know, just do what you absolutely have to do to stay fresh for that fight.
A lot of things that people, you know, one thing that a lot of people don't talk about is the athleticism required to be a high-level mixed martial arts star, as are those in the UFC. You guys measured a lot of the benchmarks tested.
Yeah, we don't have a combine as of yet, per se. And the other thing is that, and this is what I love about the sport, is it's all types and all kinds, you know? I'll bet if we got Damian Maia in here, unfortunately we haven't, I'll bet he wouldn't test off the chart in anything. But there was a time when he was one of the most feared dudes to step into the octagon with, you know? It's about taking your physical tools and matching your fighting style to it. You got like Anderson Silva. He's not a tremendous athlete. He didn't even use to strength train that much with weights back when he was, you know, at his prime. So he was just doing band work and you know, boxing work.
Another thing that I noticed was that the recommended fight night weight is within 10% of the contracted weight class. So at UFC 227, the California State Athletic Commission disclosed the fight night weights, and only 25% of the fighters were within that weight. Is there anything being developed to try and get more fighters within that threshold for fight night?
Well, yes, there is. And that is a much larger conversation that I'd probably be remiss if I tried to go too far into. But, yeah. One of the things, too, and we don't have these numbers yet. Unfortunately, we would have liked to include them in the journal. Fight night weight does not equal winning. So the heavier opponent doesn't win, per se. So it's really about finding your level of comfort within that 10 to 12% so that you're able to train and you're able to live right that week and, you know, again, you know, people always say it's like two fights, you know. You fight to make the weight and then you fight to fight. Well, it doesn't have to be. But take some of that stress off.
It's very weird. It seems like this year's kind of a statistical anomaly. A lot of the fighters that are missing weight are winning fights, whereas historically I thought that a lot of the fighters that had missed weight were losing fights. Is that just kind of a weird outlier this year?
It is. I mean, let's look at specific instances like a Mackenzie Dern or something. You know, I think you have to take it. You have to take it fight per fight, you know. But with that said, overall, the higher weight, even with those missed weights included, is not indicative of a win.
Dana White recently mentioned he wants to go back to the old way in time. Have you and your team been consulted about this, and what do you personally think of that?
Again, that's part of a larger concern. There's pros and cons to it. So, of course, I'm being diplomatic about it, but the pro to that is that the closer the weight to the actual fight, the more of a true weight that is, and the less time you're going to have to get these huge rebounds. What does that mean? If you kind of reverse engineer that, it means you're going to cut from less. So the idea is, you know, it's just simply weight classes. You know, it's not about defeating or beating or being the biggest person in the weight class. It's finding the right weight class for you, for your body type. How big can you actually be on fight night? And what are you going to feel that you're best at? You know, finding your key for performance as opposed to, you know, I just want to be the bigger guy by 3-4 pounds, whatever.
What do you think is the best solution? Like if Forrest Griffin was, you know, they said, Forrest Griffin, you need to come up with a solution for this weight cutting situation. What would you engineer as being the best solution as someone who has fought before?
Well, so unfortunately I'm, you know, that's a commission thing, first of all, but I feel like, I'm not sure that I have the perfect answer for that. I know California proposed that if you weren't within 10%, you couldn't fight for a belt. If you weren't within 10% of fight night, that was a California proposal, I'm pretty sure. I don't hate it. I think if you stop the 2, 3, 4 guys that can fluctuate that 20, 30 pounds in that 20-hour period. So I think making the weight classes, I guess, you know, after I've talked through it, I think making the weigh-ins closer to the actual fight is more indicative of a true weight, right?
Yeah, well, I always thought that doing it Thursday night would make the most sense, but after having spoken to you about it previously, you kind of swayed me the other way.
Yeah, if you do it like a Thursday night, I'm going to say, look, I have 2 full days to recover. I can destroy myself all day Thursday, you know? So I'm gonna drop God knows how much, and then I'm going to be, again, that's just hard on your system, man. And over time, it destroys your metabolism, and it really hurts you, you know? So I don't know. I you know what? Here's my new thing. Just make the weight. I don't really care how you do it. Just make the weight. Not that hard. Find the right weight class for yourself. It's probably a little verboten of me to say, but I wouldn't hate more weight classes. The argument about more weight classes is that people would naturally think, well, if I fight at 170, that's hard, but I could probably make 165, right? So then you start thinking, you know, that's the counter-argument to more weight classes.
Yeah, and I've heard that
before. You're always going to want to be... You always want to be the biggest guy in the smallest weight class. Size matters. So,
and what has the PI learned about brain rehydration? Because from what I had heard, the optimal amount of time to rehydrate your brain was 48 hours. That's kind of why I thought the Thursday night would have made the most sense.
But where'd you hear that? Give me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's exactly it. Like,
you can give me that study. So here's the way. So I've worked with some of the best. Brain surgeons, neurologists, neuropathy guys, whatever. Here's the thing about there's no change. This is a small study, but there's no change in cerebral spinal fluid. So the idea that dehydrated brain is more susceptible to concussion, that's based off the fact that your hydration brain volume is going to be lower. Even in extreme dehydration, your brain volume doesn't shrink. The other thing that most brain surgeons will tell you, is the brain is the most valuable part of the body. It is going to be the last thing to dehydrate, and it is going to be the first thing to rehydrate. Does that make sense?
It does, if that's what the studies say. I haven't really had a chance to read up on a lot of the different studies, and it seems like there are a lot of different studies that have come out on this that have different...
No. I don't know. Send them my way, but I haven't seen. I went into this thinking, yeah, dehydration definitely makes you more susceptible to concussion. And I think a lot of fighters feel that way. You know what else makes you more susceptible to getting knocked out? 4-ounce gloves. A guy that's trying to hit you as hard as he can. A guy that's trying to knock you out. The stress of fight week. A lot of things make you more susceptible to getting knocked out. So I think saying, oh, the weight cut was involved, that's why I got knocked out, that's kind of an invalid conclusion there. There's a lot of other variables that aren't being controlled. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely, and I'm happy that the PI are consulting with a lot of different neuroscientists to get to the bottom of that, because I've heard a lot of different things. I don't really know. Again, this isn't my field of expertise like it is yours, so that's why I like picking your brain on this and finding out what you've learned.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of different things too, but when you say, cool, where's the doctor that published the study? What was the sample size? How did they do it? You know, I work with a lot of smart people, and you can't find the ones that'll fool Duncan and Roman and Clint and the guys here at the PI that do this for a living. So I'm still waiting. I'm open to the idea that there's a correlation, but there's nothing remotely proven as of yet.
One thing that you do on a weekly basis is the rankings report. You and Megan O'Leary put this together. I've been a very strong advocate of changing the ranking system. I find that a lot of the different people that are submitting these rankings aren't keeping up with the sport. If you look at their individual ballots, do you agree with me in that sense? And I know that when you're presenting the ranking report, you guys are just updating on what's happening with the rankings. But do you feel like the system could be tweaked?
So there's two things. The rankings are a little confusing, right? Because the rankings are indicative of your past, your past record, right? So, you know, a guy could be ranked higher than another guy, yet the betting odds will be against that athlete. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
And sometimes that's the case because a guy wins three or four fights because he had favorable matchups, he had a short notice fight, he beat guys that were ranked relatively high, so he's ranked higher, and then he fights someone that isn't ranked as high but is a bad matchup. You know, it'll be interesting to see this Gaethje-Vick fight. Are either of them ranked?
They're both ranked.
Like, mm-hmm. What are they, like 12?
They're both in the top. Yeah, they're both like in the top 12, if I recall.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's always interesting to me when you see the rankings and then you see the Vegas odds. So, you know, again, the rankings, just like the weigh-ins. It's another thing. I started like, these are garbage, these don't work, we got to do it better. And then the more I spent researching and looking into it, the more I said, you know what, I don't really have a better way to fix the system. And 90% of the time, I agree with it. Are they wrong sometimes? Yeah. I think you should fall more in the rankings for inactivity.
Well, my issue with it is who's doing it. Like, you've got different writers doing it who could have a vested interest in it. Like, there's a guy who has Adriano Martins ranked as the ninth best lightweight in the UFC right now, and he's not in the UFC. And every week you look at his submissions, and he's got Larissa Pacheco, who hasn't fought in the UFC and was 0-2 in the UFC ranked, and she hasn't fought there in 3 years. And he's got Adriano Martins ranked in the top 10. These are things that I think need to be weeded out in order to have a fair ranking system, because with Paul Felder back at UFC 223, they wouldn't let him fight Khabib because he wasn't ranked, and he was the only guy that made 155 pounds.
Yeah, that's weird, too. That was the New York thing, right? Well, you obviously found one guy that needs to be taken out of there. He's voting on the wrong people. That's an easy win.
Another person moved Demetrius Johnson down to 13th pound for pound. Like, these are things that, from the outside looking in, I think are confusing. And I also think that as somebody covering the sport, you're dealing with managers, you're dealing with different people, you can become friendly with people, and that can create a bias. You know, I spoke to Cage Johnson about this, and he says that he thinks Fight Matrix is a good way of doing it. They have a numerical system that would determine the rankings. And to me, I think that makes a whole lot more sense.
Yeah, I don't know. Now we're going to have to go over exactly what they're ranking it on, you know? I mean, maybe Justin Gaethje is ranked the highest because he has the most volume output, but he's not winning fights.
Right, yeah, in terms of the formula. They'd have to obviously try to perfect this formula. But if you look at fightmatrix.com, their rankings seem to add up in terms of where guys actually should be ranked, which is kind of interesting.
Well, so it's funny you say that. So the rankings that are out right now are pretty close to the way athletes should be ranked. Right now, that just came out, you know, they come out every Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever, right? They're always relative. You can always find one or two to argue about, but because there's a sample size of 50, they're still pretty accurate. So I'll tell you this, they're right a lot more than they're wrong.
Yeah, especially I think at the top. I think if you look at the top five, they are where they should be. It's more, I think, in the lower part, I guess the latter half of the divisions where I seem to find a lot of different problems with it. But again, I think that there's always room for improvement in a lot of the different things that we do, and that's why the PI exists.
if you go to the fight metric system, you're going to have just as many complaints, I guarantee it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You've been around the sport for a long time. When you see how the sport's covered, is there anything that you would change in terms of how media covers the sport as an athlete?
Well, you gotta think. Of course there are, but I'm a true believer. You know, I was a basketball, football fan, and then in 1999 I found fighting, and then I kind of forsake all of the sports just to concentrate on fighting. It was the year-round sport, so, you know. I think it should be more prominent than it is, but I'm obviously a little biased.
Well, I'm talking more about how people cover the sport individually.
Well, you know, we had a very cool thing in that our media started out as fans and they were our friends, right? That was a very cool thing. But it's also a lot of, you know, kind of infighting with that, you know, and maybe these people weren't the best professionals. So a lot of people that got on the MMA media train early on weren't actually good journalists. They were just the person that knew about the UFC when most people didn't.
All right, thanks, man. Well, I appreciate your time. It's always great learning about what the PI has going on and the different studies you guys are doing. I'm looking forward to Volume 2 of, what's the name of it again?
That's a great question. I've already forgotten. No, a cross-section performance analysis and projection of the UFC athlete.
Yes, I'm looking forward to Volume 2. Do you guys have a projected date for when that might come out?
No, not at all. I'll finish up on this. The first idea was to wait 13 months, 14 months until we had enough data to present. And then we want to almost quarterly update that data and push it out, right? So there's not a reason to wait to year three. We want to tell everyone as much about the sport as there is to know as soon as possible. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah,
so
for optimal training.
As soon as we have enough data to present, you know, a new subset or whatever, or present the perfect, performance testing for the MMA athlete, we'll release that. It's just about, you know, making things right.
Well, I loved combing through it. I saw Clint and Heather back at the last event and mentioned to them how much I really enjoyed learning from that particular the particular volume. So I'm looking forward to more of that, and I think it's really great for the sport. That was Forrest Griffin. Some very interesting stuff from him about the Performance Institute, some interesting statistics regarding the different athletes in the UFC. You know, right now it's kind of a downtime for the UFC and for MMA as a whole. Not a whole lot going on, but I think business is about to pick up again in just a couple of weeks. We've got UFC in Lincoln this weekend. Then another week off. You know, it's been, I'm happy about this. We've had 3 weeks off in August. That's must be nice for the employees of the UFC also. I know that the machine is always rolling, but it's good to see. So then you've got one event in Dallas. Then you've got the event in Moscow, the first ever event in Moscow. It's coming up quick, September 15th. Then after that, you got Sao Paulo 1 week later, and then you got a week off the first week of October before, as in the calm before the storm, before Khabib and McGregor, which is also coming up very, very quickly. How many days away are we from this particular event? Days until October 6th. 46 days away. Unreal. It's really sneaking up on us. There are still tickets available for UFC 229. I mean, they'll cost you a couple thou, but there are still some left if you're interested in going to what is likely going to be the biggest event of the year in the UFC. I don't know how they could beat it unless their end-of-year card features Conor versus GSP or something along those lines, but I think that might be a bit of a long shot. You've got the MSG card, Nate Diaz on the card, but no main event still. I mean, time's ticking. Tickets for that probably going to go on sale in the next couple of weeks, so we'll have to see how that shakes out. And then, of course, you've got the event in Toronto in December, as well as the year-end event in Vegas. So a lot to look forward to in the UFC. I think that it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with UFC 228, Woodley versus Till. Because Darren Till, as I mentioned, it's crazy how quickly he ascended to a title shot, especially in a very crowded welterweight division, and with an interim title in play with Colby Covington. So Darren Till could be the next champion of the world at age 25, and that would be absolutely crazy. That would be perhaps the quickest ascent to a championship in UFC history. Well, anyways, we'll be back next week. I believe Joe will be here. Episode 53. Again, it's our one-year anniversary, so thanks to those who have supported the TSN MMA show throughout the years. And we look forward to more great shows, another year of fantastic shows to come. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to the TSN MMA show. For all the latest UFC news, visit tsn.ca/UFC.